Today we have on Mike Ditson. He started out as a technical writer, quickly transitioned to product management roles at various companies like FTP Software, RSA Securities, Response Networks, Wavesmith Networks, Groove Networks. After those stints, he transitioned to director VP level leadership roles at companies like Authoria, Kinzer Software, Square Root, Alchemy, WorldSky. And most recently, he's a VP of product strategy at Envato Group, where you work with management teams to drive GTM strategy and sales strategy. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks so much. Cool to be here. There's lots of things. First of all, make sure you understand sales is an important piece of the process and to get over your dislike of it if you have it. Second, I'd say is,
what if I'm not comfortable with that skill set? How should a founder tackle that?
Yes, hire a partner with somebody because it probably comes down to social skills and not wanting to call somebody up and ask 100%. For something. You don't want to be in, don't want to be rejected. I understand all of that. The thing that salespeople want more than anything in the world are reference customers. So part of product management is reference customers and testimonials from people so that new customers who are not the early adopters can see that somebody, quote unquote, like them has actually benefited from your product. It does what you say it does. And so that is not a small investment of time. Having experienced both, if I were to start a company, I would never start with enterprise ever, because it's a little bit of the innovator's dilemma problem.
Welcome to Funds and Founders. This weekly show is tailored for Austin founders navigating the early stages of their entrepreneurial journey. I'm your host and fellow Austinite, Abhinav Sinha. If you're looking for the motivation and the insight needed to build a successful company, you're in the right place. Hey guys, welcome back to Funds and Founders. Today we have on Mike Ditson. He started out as a technical writer, quickly transitioned to product management roles at various companies like FTP Software, RSA Securities, Response Networks, Wavesmith Networks, Groove Networks, Avaya. After those stints, he transitioned to director VP level leadership roles at companies like Authoria, Kinzer Software, Square Root, Alchemy, WorldSky. I think I covered them all.
Sounds exhausting, doesn't it? Yeah.
And most recently, he's a VP of product strategy at Envato Group, where you work with management teams to drive GTM strategy and sales strategy.
Yep, that's it.
Also a lecturer at McCombs for a course in product management.
That's correct. Yep, for two years now. Yep.
Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks so much. Cool to be here.
I heard in a past interview when you were asked, what are some advice you have for product leaders or aspiring product leaders? One of the things you said was, fall in love with the sales process and the salespeople and contribute to it as much as possible. Can you talk about it a little bit, and why do you think sales is so important for aspiring product leaders and founders?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you asked me that today. I actually, because I teach, as we were talking about earlier, I actually did that exact session this morning with my class about how product management can and should work with sales. I guess one of the things that I noticed as a product manager and then sort of transitioning into a product leadership role is a lot of the product people that came from technical backgrounds, engineers or support or some other role, were super interested in product, but for whatever reason, wildly uncomfortable with the concept of sales or salespeople. You know, sales is icky, all the negative connotations that come along with sales that are frankly not correct and not right. Like, sure, there's sleazy salespeople out there, but 99% of the profession of sales is very honorable and helping people solve problems that they have. And I noticed that at one point in my career, whatever it was, and got comfortable with it. I had early on kind of mentors or leaders that pointed out that sales is everybody's job inside the company. And in a non-sales role, what that means is you're somehow contributing to the overall closing of business. And I'll use it from the earlier, some book I read, it's don't mean a thing if it don't go ka-ching, you know? So like everyone's working towards a common goal, which is growing the business. And product, there's so many ways that you can help build the business and help salespeople, but you also have to play it against the, hey, turns out sales is really fun when you get pulled into those things, but you can't be a 100%, you know, sales support person. 100%. If that's what you're doing all the time, you're not doing your day job, which is really to be a product manager.
Yeah.
And so you kind of got to balance those two things, I guess. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think once you get over sort of the initial, make sure you understand the role of sales in a lot of companies, senior management talks to the direct salespeople a lot more than they talk to you in the product role. They probably talk to you, but they're probably calling the two or three best salespeople multiple times a week to say, you know, hey, what's going on? How's XYZ deal? Yada, yada, yada. So you should just recognize that and work it to your advantage career-wise, but also to the, you know, the benefit of your product.
100%. To add on to that, sales is important. It's important for early stage companies. Founder-led sales is also a big thing in this space, right? For a tech co-founder without sales experience, what are the first steps in building a competent sales team or effective sales process that they can learn, adapt, grow, or tackle to get to that point? Because a lot of founders don't have the sales experience that you would warrant to do this. How do you recommend they go about that?
Sure. So I should certainly caveat it with, I've never been a salesperson myself. I've only been sales adjacent. Yeah. So I have a lot of appreciation for it. So there might be something that, you know, a professional sales manager would say that's different than what I observe. However, having been around a lot of people like that, I guess there's lots of things. First of all, all that stuff I said before about, you know, make sure you understand what that sales is an important piece of the process and to get over your fear or dislike of it if you have it. Second, I'd say it probably has a lot to do with kind of the stage the company you're at. So if we're talking early stage startup with no sales that have happened, the real goal is probably to get from that stage where it is founder-led sales to where you're switching gears to sort of the scale-up stage. So in Bottle Group, where I work now, that's a lot of what we help do. Meaning in the startup process, you do your pitch 100 times a day, right? You get your wrap down about whether you're pitching to investors or pitching to people you're trying to recruit into your company or actual prospects that you're trying to sell something to. And the challenge is that you're living it, breathing it, you know where all the bodies are buried, you've heard all of the objections before, but the level up, so to speak, that you're after is how to do that sales process without you needing to be there as the founder, right? And it's near impossible to just transfer all that knowledge easily to whoever your first salesperson is or your sales leadership. So a little bit depends on, you know, who you have in as the people doing actual sales. And a little bit of it is how you go about it, maybe by stage. Certainly, you know, I've been in situations at certain companies where we have, I won't say the name of the company, but startup here in town, great company, love all the people. I had an ongoing consulting business with lots of revenue that employed a bunch of people and was endeavoring to become a product company. So took something that the company had from some of its larger consulting customers and trying to productize it, right? In that kind of format, we had multiple salespeople and good salespeople that were sort of tasked with selling the consulting business out there, but then also trying to figure out, you know, what's our product? We were essentially pre-product market fit, right? I don't know what book I got out of it. I got it from a million years ago, but there's kind of two types of salespeople, sort of explorer salespeople and then racehorse salespeople. And what we typically think of when we think of as salespeople, quote unquote, is the racehorse person. It's basically someone who's comes in, is a great salesperson, can sell ice to Eskimos, and you know, you just give them, here's the training, here's the your comp plan, go. That's great if you if you're post product market fit when you know all that stuff and it's just coin operated.
You have the playbook. You just need to.
You have the playbook. It's just pouring gas on it, right? The challenging one is the explorer salesperson. If you have that right person, it's almost a product person in that they're helping break trail on what your deal is and what it's going to be a repeatable sales cycle is going to look like. Long-winded answer to your question.
I think just quick tangent there. For a founder who doesn't understand the sales process, yes, there are things you can learn to do, shadow, understand what's going on. What if I'm not comfortable with that skill set, right? Like, it's very possible that sales is just not in my DNA.
Yeah.
Do I go hire a salesperson? Do I still try to understand that process? And I'm talking about more early stage where you are still trying to find PMF. How should a founder tackle that? Because I'm trying to, for potential listeners, try to, hey, you have a product, you have some traction, but you're still trying to understand what works, what doesn't work. Do you hire someone? Do you not hire someone?
My gut reaction is, yes, hire a partner with somebody because usually the piece that they're not comfortable with is not technical background, somebody, they can understand a process and break things down and understand what a sales funnel is and what the steps of a sales cycle is. It probably comes down to social skills and not wanting to call somebody up and ask 100%. For something. You don't want to be in position to people. You don't want to be rejected. Yeah. I understand all of that because I have plenty of, I've had all of those kind of feelings as well. So, find somebody who is great at it. You know, I know a sales guy who is like the ultimate inside sales guy. He can call up anybody and get a meeting. It seems like almost magic. You know, he's just got the ability of gift of gab and has no qualms about calling up somebody cold and being like, hey, how you doing? Blah, 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 blah. It's a super skill of some sort. But if you don't have it, it's way faster and easier to find someone who does.
Makes sense. Going back to your journey, your professional journey, you did a bunch of stints as PM. And at some point, you transitioned to leadership level roles where you're director, VP plus, and you're leading product teams instead of being an IC per se. Can you describe the transition of going from IC role to more of a leader role? What does that entail? What are the key changes? And were there any challenges that you faced going from, hey, I own a product to I own a team that owns a team of products?
Yeah, 100%. It was a big change, big difference. And I'd call it bumpy. So the ironic thing was when I made that switch from individual contributor to manager, I was at a company that sold talent management software. And so literally all day long, we were talking about performance management, compensation management, recruiting, and all this HR stuff, because all of our customers were, you know, enterprise corporate HR departments. And so all of the product stuff I'd been talking about for 3 or 4 years was all that kind of stuff. So you'd think you would, you know, make the connection. Hey, Mike, you're coming into the same job today, but in a new role. And guess what? You know, now the product isn't the product. Your product is your team. You know, whatever. Personally, I think I benefited from the fact that I'm pretty genial person and easy to get along with. I'm not one of these hard driving in terms of, you know, I'm not a screamer or yeller or anything like that. I'm not like a hard ass kind of a boss. But the flip side of that is I'm also a little bit too nice in those positions. Yeah. And it took me a while to learn how to manage. Like I was probably 35 before I started managing other people. Like as a product manager, you're mostly an individual contributor forever. So there were good pieces and not so smooth pieces, I guess.
What's one of the biggest challenges that you had going from IC? Was it the management piece or because I've managed a couple of folks in my career and I feel like there's a lot of aspects of it that I wasn't aware of. How do you have effective one-on-ones? How do you work with people who report to you to upskill and at the same time match what they're expecting from the role and the years that they spend there? And there, I could go, like, there's a lot of like facets to being a manager.
Sure.
Are there any things that stood out?
There are things that are pretty smooth, like some of the rituals, one-on-one things, like I'm a book nerd, so I'd read all the Peter Drucker. I'd read, you know, the High Output Management from Andy Grove. So I knew a lot of that stuff and I implemented a lot of it. That was okay. I think things that I was less good at or hadn't consciously spent time learning when I was younger, I think the biggest one is deliberately assessing other people and their performance. Like, I know I like this person. I like that person. This guy's kind of a jerk. You know, I know this person's really good at this, but I don't think I had put in the time to like really get good at doing that assessment. So for instance, hiring was difficult for me when I first made that transition because I like people and you're a round peg. I can fit you in my square hole. And I turn an interview into me trying to close you on why you should come work for me. I'm good at that. But the piece that I had to learn, and I think I since have, hopefully it's been a long time, has been the part where it's like, okay, Abhinav, you're coming to interview with me for a job. Your experiences and skill sets a match for what I'm looking for, kind of thing. That was one of the big ones that, you know, it just never occurred to me, I don't think. And I got better at over the years.
It's funny how one of the startups I've worked at, part of the interview process was, okay, let's put you through all these motions. And the last call was, oh, let's sell you on the role, right? And like, I understand that whole idea, but it's the first time where I saw, oh, as a startup, as an early company, as a small company, you could have the best talent in front of you. You still have to, as a hiring manager, make the sale or close the deal and convince them to come work for this unstructured early company where nothing's set in stone, right? And
yeah.
the first time I saw it, I'm like, oh, you got to do that in a small company. That's part of your job and responsibilities to make sure you're recruiting the right person, but also giving them the vision. And so it was interesting to see that as part of the interview
process. I had a one of the companies I worked for was a startup, and I guess it was end of 99, start of 2000 kind of time period. And it was called Wavesmith Networks. And they were in stealth mode. And this was, you know, early on, not a lot of companies did stealth mode, but this was before, like everybody's heard of it now. But back then it was like, well, what do you mean stealth mode? And it was one of these things you had to sign the NDA. And I didn't find out what the company did until they made me the job offer.
Okay.
Then they put the sales thing on. Yeah. This is what we do, blah, 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 and whatever.
Funny, if you go on LinkedIn, stealth company has like 17 or 18,000 people who have stealth company as their current job.
Really?
And I'm just curious, what are these people actually building? Because that would be a decent number of companies that are quote unquote stealth, right?
So
just interesting to see how people have.
In their defense at that time, it was a really good reason they were in stealth mode is because they were competing with a very specific vendor whose employees they wanted to steal. So which they did a good job of kind of thing. So anyway,
makes sense.
Whatever.
Another thing in your transition, what's the biggest change in responsibility? So being an ICPM, you own a product, the product vision, the outcomes. Is the shift more manage people that manage products, or is it more defined strategy to determine what the products are and what the OKRs and everything would be for that team or whatever you own?
I think it's a bit of both, because you become the shield to the rest of the organization. So management stakeholders in terms of now you're running the team, you own the whole roadmap and all of the products. They kind of take away from you sort of the fun part in terms of the actual. You stop building things on your own, or at least you're at least once removed, if not more, from the cool part of building the products for sure. And yes, you're absolutely now trying to think about team and how you're building team and what team you're going to need. But the other piece, I think, is whenever there's an issue, the first stop, you know, if there's an issue with one of your team members on one of the products, a lot of times the escalated first stop from, you know, angry VP of sales, angry, you know, customer support VP or whoever it is comes to you.
Yeah.
And then, you spend a lot of time trying to unwind those issues kind of thing. And frankly, that can be fun, but it is different than being a straight product manager for sure.
And add on to that thought, when you've gone into more of a leader role, how does one stay in tune with everything your team's working on, the smaller level movements on the products, the changes, updates, outcomes? How have you stayed in touch with sort of that side of it? Is that clear? What am I asking?
Yeah, I think so. Some of being a product manager as an individual contributor is, which I think is still what I'm best at, even after all this time. Part of it is developing kind of the spidey senses of knowing when to go deep on something and when you can say the engineers get it, they can do it without me, or and I'll just touch base quickly on whatever. And I think some of that was imparted to me or came along with me when I did some of the leadership stuff.
Yeah.
Certainly there's all things we talked about, like the one-on-ones and making sure you're checking in with people on how they are and what they're working on. But the detail stuff, you're removed enough from that you're not, unless it's a feature kind of marked as a, this is slated for XYZ deal or OKR that we're after. Those you probably want visibility on and want to watch. But the nitty gritty stuff is definitely handled at a level below you.
Makes sense. Sweet. Shifting gears a little bit. So pricing, and for early stage startups, pricing can be a pain point and sort of unknown territory of how do I price, especially when you're doing B2B versus B2C versus enterprise, SMB. Like there's a lot of factors that go into play. Do you have a process for determining how you price products and how it fits with the target customer base you're working in? And primarily, if I'm correct, you've done more B2B SaaS kind of stuff in your experience, right? So how do you think about that? What's your process for figuring out pricing strategy when you've had to work on that kind of stuff?
Yeah, my running joke is the only thing worse than having to be in a naming meeting as a pricing meeting, because everyone's got an opinion and it can be hard to know what a right answer is. At least at the end of the day, name is just arbitrary. You know, what are we going to call this product or company? For pricing, I don't know if I've done it enough to have a system that's consistently used or reused. was having a conversation with a former person I worked with who came to speak to my class last week about pricing, who's really got a strong opinion that product should definitely own pricing inside the company. And I would say...
versus RevOps or sales, or who would be the other person that owns it if not?
At a startup, it would be the CEO. I've worked at some places where sales is owned pricing.
Okay, got it.
And so I'd say it's probably been 50% of the time that I owned it. And some of those times are places that I've inherited it. So it's been even fewer times where I've actually had to come up with it. But where I have had to come up with it, typically kind of depends on the environment that you're selling in. So times that I'm thinking of, we were selling solutions into larger system products that have a known pricing model. So you want to not be different than that pricing model. So the one that leaps to my mind is a while back, but RSA Security. So I worked for, they used to have these secure ID tokens that you would carry around that have one-time password. They do the same thing when you log into the Bank of America or anything like that today. They just do it through your phone as your token now. But back then, you'd have to have a piece of software that would front end whatever platform you were protecting. So I had to do it for an AS400 platform. So that's god awful old. That dates me, I'm sure. I had to do it for Lotus Notes. I had to do it. And so the pricing had to match a Lotus Notes customer's pricing. And so we had multiple pricing models for what was essentially the same product on our side, but was getting sold into different platforms kind of thing. Just general pricing, I guess. I adhere to the Mark Andreessen theory of just, you know, raise prices. If you're, especially if you're a startup, you can always discount and you can always, not that you should, but you have the option if you have something, it's much higher to, harder to go higher than to go lower, right?
100%.
And you can always do it as a negotiating, this is a one-time special price for you, but you definitely want to maintain the value. There's a fantastic book called The Dollarization Discipline, I believe it's called. It's basically, you know, how you break down and understand the true value of your product. It, you know, it's the proverbial, we don't sell drills, we sell holes in wood kind of thing. And understanding what that value is, the first step in understanding how you're going to price whatever that product is.
Got it.
Working through that, which I would say is really hard and painful, is where you want to start.
I was listening to a random podcast where someone said you should be changing your prices at least 3 times a year, if not at least once a year, up to 3 times a year, because you always want to understand what's changing. Does the market like this, not like this? Do my customers like this, like this? Are there certain metrics or factors or data points that you look at to determine whether the pricing's right, the churn's not too high, not too low? What's your go-to? Like, what are your go-to metrics to analyze that situation?
Yeah, I think you named them. I mean, it's the revenue and this churn. And like the same guy I was talking about a few minutes ago at his company, which is a SaaS company, he built in the contract that there would be automatic price ups raises every year. And every year he'd have some people call up and complain, but most didn't. They just take the new price. And then he could always bring it back down for those that complained. And, you know, it was a very savvy way of doing it and was useful and grew a fantastic business. So
first time I've heard of automatic price raise, because I know there's always probationary periods of like, oh, here, we're going to raise from like a year out. FYI, you have a year of like the same pricing, but unless you change it. So I've seen a lot of that, but I've never seen or heard of like.
Well, the thing is that's nice is if you built in those, it's not just the price. It's not just this amount per month, per user, whatever. It's also all of those different extra things, which are just levers that you can use to negotiate for customers that might churn or are complaining about price or what have you. So it's useful.
100%. For B2B SaaS companies with traction, but they're not sure about whether they've hit product market fit or they have product market fit, do you have any advice on how someone can better understand where they lie and whether they've achieved the fit or they're still trying to figure out product market fit?
A good question that I don't have a clean answer to. I think the traditional answer would be the, if you have product market fit, you'll know it, right? It's flying off the shelves. I think the iteration that you're doing in terms of trying to find product market fit is one of the core pieces of product discovery for 100%. A product manager. I work in product, and when I'm teaching product stuff, I don't talk as much about the sort of high level product market fit from the full product, because that's just, at least in my class, that's more of an entrepreneur's issue, obviously. In product management, you're typically working with a product that's out there. But I do talk half jokingly about feature market fit, yeah, which is, you know, the whole product model, which is you don't just push it out and assume that it works and it's what you want. You also take the time to go back and measure, are the dogs eating the dog food?
Yeah.
And if so, if not, what do we need to change on the feature to make sure it's getting properly adopted to solve whatever problem that it was built for, kind of thing.
What would you say in the B2B SaaS space, there's different metrics you look at? Because I've asked a bunch of people what their take on product market fit is, and everyone has a slightly different take on it, right? Like, they'll look at a slightly different number. One person mentioned, if your customer or like SMB enterprise customer renews after your initial contract, they consider that product market fit, where you've solved a good enough problem where they're out of the initial phase and they want to keep buying it, right? Different people have different definitions.
Yeah.
Do you have something that you refer to outside of the flying off the shelf, but like, I mean, in the B2B SaaS?
I'm going to have a brain cramp, but the pirate metrics are, have you heard of those before?
No, I haven't heard of them.
Oh, okay. So Dave McClure, 100 or 1,000 startups, whatever, an investor that invested in a bunch of little time. I think he was the person that coined pirate metrics, and it was R, like a pirate. I'm going to forget what they are, but it's a funnel. So it's like acquisition, revenue, and churn or whatever. I'm butchering what the actual letters stood for. But that's a great method to look up and use to see if you're acquiring customers, but also if they're staying and not churning. That's a model that is useful and I would check out. I don't know as it gets used for SaaS products a bunch as well.
We'll add a screenshot next
year. Yeah. Oh, perfect.
I was trying to look it up, but the net isn't loading.
Oh. I should remember it because I actually have a class, actually it's in a couple of weeks, that I'm going to teach it in, but I just I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Pretty good. And the reason I like asking the PMF question, especially to experienced product folks, is it's very interesting to see how someone looks at it depending on what they've seen, where they're on their career, and how much like different kind of product stuff they've seen. Everyone has a slightly different notion to it, right? And I like understanding that take just for myself.
I think it also really, just in enterprise software, SaaS business, it really matters what end of the market you're looking at. So enterprise customers, depending on how you define that, but assume that they're the largest customers. The deal flow is so much longer and fewer customers, because there's by definition fewer of those prospects, is harder to get a sense. Like in the situations where I was working in companies where the target market was SMB, so much easier to figure out, to get to the right pricing, to get to the right metrics to figure out, because you just have so many more at-bats. Yeah. So I guess it's kind of obvious, but useful if you're thinking about, should I go down market or up market? One benefit of down market is, yes, there's less meat on the bone, but there's a lot more of them. So
100%. I've heard a lot of varying takes on SMB versus enterprise, which to attack, which not to attack. And I think at the core of it, it just depends on,
I have a really strong opinion if you want.
Yeah, for sure. No, I was just going to say, from depending on the founder, they're both very different kinds of products and companies to build. When you're building for the SMB space, you have very different challenges than when you're building for the enterprise space.
Yeah.
And you got to be aware of what you're getting into, right? Building the right product is probably only 40% of that journey. And there's a lot of sales, a lot of understanding the customer, the mindset. And those are two very different on that space.
Yeah.
But you were going to say.
I was going to say, having experienced both, if I were to start a company, I would never start with enterprise ever, ever, ever. Because it's a little bit of the innovator's dilemma problem. It's so much easier to start at the bottom and compete up than it is. It's almost impossible to start with an enterprise product with the cost basis of an enterprise product and try to compete down. And having done that when I worked at Athoria, which we talked about before, we were shooting for enterprise customers. We had lots of enterprise customers and we wanted to go down market. It was near impossible for us. And our biggest competitor was someone you may have heard of called SuccessFactors, which started much, much tighter focus, much smaller customers. And they came up and we went away and they got sold to SAP for $3 billion. So, and then other you know, subsequent experiences I've had at companies, you can start out, SMB is a customer that you can quote unquote push around. And I don't mean that in the bad sense.
Yeah.
I kind of do, I guess. You have more power as a software vendor. You can say no and bide your time until you can 100%. Invest in the features that solve higher level problems. And you can do that over time and get revenue to stay alive and grow in time to go up market. But going down market, it's near impossible to do it the other direction.
I like that. No, I've never heard that side of it. I've heard from an acquisition point of view, very different challenges, very different kinds of sales cycles. Enterprises are bigger deals if you have the right problem, the right sales motion, but you're waiting sometimes months.
And if you're small, you'll be completely whipped around by those enterprise customers.
One of the places I worked, larger company, we were signing a deal with an IDP, and it was a small deal for the team I was on, but it took us 11 to 12 months to get through legal paperwork because the process is on our side. And the company came back saying, I've spent more in legal fees than your actual contract value, at which point we don't want to do this anymore, but they wanted the larger contract. They wanted to get in. Once you do the MSA, you can only get more teams, right? Like once you're out of the paperwork, so they still stuck with it. But when he said, I was like, have we really taken so long that they're losing money on the small deal we're making in the hopes of catching a bigger fish?
But
a smaller company will go through the same thing. At some point, you can't bear that. You can't bear that timeline, that loss, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to be very aware of what you're getting into.
Right.
I met some local founders who were building software to sell to universities. And an interesting take the founder had was, you have the good software, doesn't matter. You have to understand you're in the university selling business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different business than a SaaS business because you're working with buyers. They only sign once a year. And if someone changes, leadership changes, budget gets cut.
Yeah, do over.
And like you're a year in with no outcome. And understanding that that's the business you're in is very important. Similarly, in the SME enterprise space, understanding which business you're in could have the best SaaS product, but you got to understand who you're selling to, how they buy, what their cycles are. And if you don't,
lots of the companies that I've been in have experienced different versions of that problem, which is like, oh, we sell great in commercial, but like, now we're going to go sell to government. You know, well, good luck. If you don't have a sales rep who understands how to sell to government, you're not going to figure it out this quarter, guys. Yeah. You know, so in different things like education, 100%. Things like that. You're right. Yeah.
Sweet. Talking a little bit more about B2B SaaS, how have top of the funnel strategies evolved over the past 5-10 years? You've been in the space for a while. You've done B2B SaaS. How have top of the funnel strategies changed? And are there any new channels or strategies that you've seen be more effective? There's a bunch of AI stuff going on. There's all these new tools, automation, sales motion, everything you can think of.
So when you ask top of funnel strategies, are you just saying, how are we changing the way we gather or capture prospective customers get them into the
lead gen kind of things?
Yeah. Okay. So I think the past 5-10 years, the big switch has been a lot more money invested in content, creating content that sort of brings the people to you and is more of a, I don't know what the right words are, but more of a soft sell or the user does most of their research before they talk to you the first time kind of thing. So definitely a lot of strategies around nurture streams that involve multiple touch points that are educational in nature of one sort or another. And that's kind of the soften up to get them to actually do something that indicates some kind of purchase or buying behavior, whether they're coming to a webinar or will actually take the call from your sales rep or what have you kind of thing. That's good and bad. Bad because it takes more time and investment to
and
do
it.
And
long game. It's not a...
It's a longer game. I think it's a more productive one over the long run, if assuming that you as a company have something interesting or informative to say. If you really have a different, you know, better mousetrap or a different approach, those are great things to spend time on. So in my current day job at Envato, we do that a lot with different customers, which is they're going from a reactive sales model where it is just who called and I'll talk.
Inbound lead, let's go.
Inbound, versus trying to transition to that place where you're turning into a scale up where you're, like, as we talked about before, getting other people to be able to sell besides the founders And that nurture stream, which is sort of the initial set of lead generation or demand generation activity, is around taking your special sauce or whatever is interesting about your approach and turning it into something compelling that people want to learn about. Much easier said than done sometimes.
100%.
Because a lot of the companies out there are pretty me too, or may have a completely valid value proposition and offering, but it's sometimes hard to be distinctive and you really need to figure that out. So we often try to, you know, we start with a thing called a core messaging platform where we try to suss that out of a company. You're getting all your basic selling propositions and benefits, but also identifying your distinctive competence and how you're going to talk about that and turning it into a narrative, editorial calendar, and then, you know, set of touch points.
For someone starting out, someone early stage, what's your recommendation for building the, should they invest heavily in, let's assume they have product market fit, they know what they're selling.
Okay.
Do they invest in content, nurture sequences, in building that pipeline? What's your recommendation for someone earlier in their journey?
No, not content necessarily. I mean, you'll get there for sure. I would say if you're right at the point, it's the same for entrepreneurs and for product management in this case, which is the thing that salespeople want more than anything in the world are reference customers. If you're a brand new product, you know, this is straight out of Crossing the Chasm.
Yeah.
I know you're going to ask later, you know, what things do I recommend as resources? So Crossing the Chasm is the first one. Everyone should read it, especially if you're business to business. It hasn't changed much in 30 years, but it's still completely valid. Part of product management is building the first, in the book, it's six customers, but however many of those first customers are, you need reference customers and testimonials from people so that new customers who are not the early adopters can see that somebody, quote unquote, like them has actually benefited from your product. It does what you know, say it does. And so that is not a small investment of time. It's not just product management. There's marketing involved. There's legal involved, because if you throw into the deal, can we use you as a reference? Your coach and champion is like, sure, yeah. But then it hits the legal desk and then you're trying to close the deal to get the money at the same time. You know, they don't want to let you talk or use their logo on the website kind of thing. So there's all those different things. Plus, once you land one, that's going to be someone who's going to talk on your behalf. There's 100 different ways that you can cut that up and use that. You know, there's the printed version. There's the video version. There's the case study version. There's the how do we use this person on a list so that they'll actually do a reference call for you. There's customer advisory boards to try to nurture them and get to meet each other kind of thing. And so doing all that kind of stuff is super high value and will pay in dividends, but is a big investment of time.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. There's so many things that, like, so I have an agency, software startup, and there's so many things I realized year four, year five, where I was like, maybe I should have started this year one and, you know, built this pool of testimonials, reference customers, build this pipeline of case studies and started doing SEO and blogs, even though I'm not expecting it to reap any rewards, but it's more like you're saying the notion of put out there what you do, how you do it, what's the value, what's the problem, what are you solving? And I just didn't realize it, but it's a long game. You got to put as much time as you can.
It's good and it's hard because it's not just a reference customer. It's a reference customer like your prospect. So yeah. They want to be from the same vertical, or they want to be somehow similar. And you as an entrepreneur or even a product person in an existing company, you don't know what that is yet necessarily. You don't necessarily know where your toehold's going to be unless you're planful about it and get to the point where you're being deliberate about it.
100%.
So,
100%. Hey there, Austin Pet Parents. Are you tired of scrambling for a reliable pet sitter every time you're away? Or maybe you're a pet lover looking to lend a helping hand to your neighbor's need? Well, listen up, because I've got something exciting to share with you. Introducing Neighbor's Pet, the innovative dog boarding platform that's changing the game for pet care. Here's how it works. Neighbor's Pet operates on a credit system. When you host someone's furry friend, you earn credits that you can use to have your own pet taken care of when you're away. It's a win-win for everyone involved. Plus, Neighbor's Pet isn't just a service, it's a community. You'll connect with other pet parents in your area, building trust and forming bonds with fellow animal lovers who understand the importance of reliable pet care. So whether you're planning a weekend getaway or simply need a helping hand with your four-legged friend, Neighbor's Pet has you covered. Sign up today and join the growing community of pet parents who are leaning on each other for peace of mind and the love their pets deserve. Visit neighborspet.com to learn more and get 2 free credits when you sign up. Free credits means free nights of boarding because as busy pet parents, it's your turn to be off leash. Sign up for Neighbor's Pet today. Sweet. Switching gears a little bit from B2B SaaS stuff to more product management, growing, and your professional journey. How have you continued to learn and adapt to the changing tech landscape? You've been doing this, I want to say, since 1997 is when you started working in the field. Over the past 25 years, there's been multiple inflection points in just processes, systems, the tech, everything.
Yep.
So how do you continue to adapt, be aware of what's going on, use the latest methods, latest tech?
Yeah, so the most obvious thing right now is AI, right? Like that's the big conversation in product management is, do we need product managers anymore because all this AI is going to do it? The person who lots of people follow is this guy, Marty Kagan, who's Silicon Valley product group. Yeah, he's awesome. And their whole group's set of books are awesome. The sort of product theater, all these product teams have hired all these different roles that they may or may not need. I tend to side with him that I think he's completely right. There are a whole lot of things that will be replaced by AI, but I don't want to speak for him, but my impression is he thinks this is that true product management adds true value. And you know, something like AI is going to do the same thing for product managers as it does for, you know, really good coders. They'll become better coders and be able to do more things more effectively with the help of an AI co-pilot kind of thing. You're kind of alluding to like all the changes of the past 25-ish years. The biggest change in product management in my mind is just the plethora of resources. Like there is, like I produce this big resource list for my class at UT that I just keep adding to and adding to because there's zillions of books, zillions of tools, zillions of applications. There's too many, frankly. But back in the day, I don't think I've ever used that phrase, but back in the day, there was one class. It was this thing called Pragmatic Marketing, which was wonderful, but it was like a 2.5-day class that product managers would go to get and I learned about it because they didn't teach about it in universities anywhere. And to some extent, they don't do it a whole lot still today. The thing that's just the same in product management is that company to company, they don't practice it the same. And people not in the role typically still don't understand what good product management looks like, unfortunately.
Over the years, is there a particular learning experience that has changed your approach of how you implement new tech, how you learn about new tech, how you find new methodologies, or do you have a certain set of principles you stick by that more or less don't change with whether the landscape is changing or not?
I'd say it's probably the latter, that I don't think they change a lot, but they do evolve for sure. I first did Agile at Athoria. A different product manager was actually the person who introduced it into Athoria. I'd never heard of it. And I'd never actually made the distinction to say what we were doing was, you know, waterfall. So when it hit me, I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. And that was great. Unfortunately, that's probably the last time that I've been in a situation where I thought it was really done super effectively. Like ever since, I've been in a lot of different companies that do water scrum fall or some version of Agile that, you know, I would say that the management teams are like, when they hear Agile, they're like, oh, I can change my mind all the time. This is awesome. Give me more of that Agile stuff. But the problem is that no one ever took them to school to help them to understand that they have a responsibility in this whole Agile thing where they need to behave in certain ways to make it effective kind of thing. And so it runs the gamut and how that kind of works kind of thing. Some things like that have evolved in terms of how I've interacted with them over the years, I guess.
Makes sense. A couple quick questions I like to ask every guest towards the end is, do you have a recommended product stack or sales tech stack that you recommend to folks you're working with, either within Envato or just any startup that you're working with?
Yeah, not typically. I just think of tools as tools. And like personally, I, you know, use all of it, feels like, because we embed with our customers. Yeah. So we sometimes have to use what they're using and be flexible that way, which isn't really a problem. If they're starting from scratch or starting over kind of thing, you know, we use WP Engine for their website and we usually use HubSpot for their CRM stuff, but we're not married to that either. So
makes
if they're using other things, we'll go use their things.
quick question about the work you do at Envato. When you're embedding with a management team, building out GTM sales processes or pipelines or motions, whatever you call them, how do you ensure that those principles, the process, what you guys help set up, sticks with them long-term? Because you're only there for a certain period of time, right?
It's not critical. I don't think that it stays long-term, but that is kind of part of the intention, right? The sweet spot for us, I guess, for us is just before or just at product market fit and through that scale-up period where they're, you know, maybe they got new investment and the pressure's coming on to sell, 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 but guess what? They don't know how to sell and don't know how to build a marketing organization. And so along with some of the stuff we do, we have the fractional marketing team and we just come in and help do it. The part of the value prop is if we've done our job right in 18 months or 2 years, you're going to get rid of us. You're going to hire your own VP of marketing or CMO or whatever. And then she or he is going to do what they want, which is the way they should. But we are trying to build in, you know, it's not rocket science how to do marketing and sales to launch and do some of these early market motions. So setting some foundational things in terms of here's a core messaging platform, here's, you know, a voice of the customer artifacts, here's certain, you know, sales artifacts. You know, we also do things like setting up your CRM if you don't have one. Yeah. But if the new CMO is a Salesforce person, you're going to get Salesforce, or rather it's the VP of sales. But, you know, we do try to help set some of that foundation, but
makes sense.
It's flexible, right?
Makes sense. You mentioned a book earlier. What are three resources that you would recommend either to early product managers in their career and or founders who are building companies? Just could be a book, podcast, resource, blog, tool, whatever. It can be more than three. I
could probably go on forever, so I'll try not to. But the one I mentioned was Crossing the Chasm, Jeffrey Moore. Everything he's written, I think, is frankly brilliant. Crossing the Chasm is a very, it's a B2B book. So if you're not a B2B person, you don't necessarily have to read it. If you are a B2B person and don't read it, you're hurting yourself. You're missing yourself. You're missing out, kind of thing. There's tons of books. I love the Acquired podcast. I don't know if you're listening to that one, but if you go back and find the companies you like, I just love what they do. I like all kinds of technology history. So that's a great one just to get into the mindset and idea and understand, especially if you're young and haven't heard of half of these companies. One of the things that I've been exposed to lately, which is really interesting, is from MIT. It's called Orbit. Have you ever heard of this? I don't know if it's publicly available yet. So there's a book called The Disciplined Entrepreneur, or Disciplined Entrepreneurship is what it's called. That's been around for 10, 15 years, something like that. And it's by some professor at MIT. And it's basically 24 steps to execute on a startup idea. And MIT has recently built an LLM that follows the steps of the book. And it's kind of stunning when you use it, how fast it is, you know, just like you're using ChatGPT, except it's got the book's thinking in terms of these steps in it, and it will spit out answers. And it's just like using ChatGPT. It's just, it's not the perfect answer, but it's way better than starting from a blank page. I have early access to it, so it's how I know about it. It's actually the guy who gave me my first product management job in 96-97 actually works at MIT, and that's how I have access. But I know they're looking to put out access to people in education, at the business schools and things like that. So it's something to look for when it's posted. It's orbitmit.edu.
Yeah, we'll link everything in the...
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah. I ask every guest to give me a question for a future guest. So your question is, are you open to accepting randomness?
Wow, that's a deep one. Who knows? Who was this guest that gave
it? It's Ken from Yesterday.
Am I open to randomness? I guess the answer is yes. I sometimes play the game of, if this hadn't happened, would I live in Austin? Would I be married to my wife? Would I be at this job and that job? So I guess I have been open to randomness for sure, because in hindsight, many of those things look pretty random. If I hadn't met so-and-so, I wouldn't have gotten this job. If I hadn't done XYZ, the next thing wouldn't happen. So
in full transparency, the question started out with, are you open to being an entrepreneur and what that entails? And he was talking through the question, and it ended up becoming, are you open to accepting randomness? Because he related the two of entrepreneurship being very close to, hey, random shit's going to happen. And
are you prepared?
Like, that's how this question evolved.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think you have to be. Being a product manager isn't as hard as being an entrepreneur. I've been real close to a lot of entrepreneurs, and there's a difference. making payroll is different than, you know, the getting paid to do product 100%. Management. But the thing I like about product management, I always liked about, is there's a lot of white space in the organization, and you have agency as a product manager to say, that's part of my product, and insert yourself in it. And I've always liked that. I think that's one of the things that, if you're good at, makes you a good product manager.
Yeah. I fundamentally believe, like, there's a lot of frameworks, there's charts prior to, like, there's all these techniques to do product management. My gut is always, you have to understand intuition, customer intuition. You have to know what a customer is saying and be able to look at data and figure out a path forward. Like, there's a lot of frameworks you can use. There's a lot of prioritizing techniques, and there's a lot of stuff. I don't even know half the frameworks available. But my fundamental belief is, at the core of it, you have to understand what a customer wants. What problem are you trying to solve?
Yeah.
And what solution is the customer looking for? Because they're never going to tell you. So you have to be able to like take all these inputs and be like, well, here's what I'm going to build for you, because here's what I think you'd need, right? But it's just a random tidbit about.
Yeah, it's like, the classic, if I ask my customers what they want, they'd want a faster horse, Henry Ford thing, right? You're absolutely right, which is the whole product model emphasis on product discovery and falling in love with the problem, not the solution, 100%. And then making sure that there's a viable business model to that goes around that value proposition, and putting them together, and 1 + 1 = 20, hopefully.
Random question. Is there anything about Gen AI, LLMs, or the whole boom that's sort of exciting you, or something you're looking forward to? It could be anything, just doesn't have to be product related.
Yes and no. I was slow to get there on Gen AI. I was like, yeah, but it can do these. It was like a parlor trick. It was all these parlor tricks. Yeah. That was how people would explain it to you.
Yeah.
I've since obviously kind of converted, just having subscribed and started using it for lots of different things. I don't know as I know. I believe that there will be surprising things that come out of it that will be great. I don't know as I can anticipate what they are. So it's not like I'm saying I can't wait till Gen AI does X, Y, Z. I find it is a useful co-pilot. It's great for no blank pages. That's the best thing that I use it for. It's like, you know, I use it. I hope none of my students are listening. I use it to prep for case studies. Yeah. I put the case study in, and then I have a conversation with, you know, ChatGPT about the case. And that's how I form my lesson plans for it. I love it for that. But same with work. It's written press releases for me, which
makes sense.
First version aren't good. But wow, it's so much faster to get to the right version with at least the first cut kind of thing. So speed.
One of the most interesting things, I have a friend in town who's trying to help me figure out a content lifecycle for like the pods. And we found a random shorts generating tool, uploaded a podcast, and it gave me 20 shorts in less than 15 minutes.
Cool.
Gave me a virality score.
Yeah.
Gave me potential titles, script to put on LinkedIn versus Twitter.
Yeah.
And it's not perfect, but it's 80% of the job.
And it's also a bunch of stuff that you probably don't have time. It's just, you're not going to do it all now, or very little, or here and there.
If I was going to do 2 or 4 shorts, I can now do 20.
Yeah.
Right? Attention span is so low with shorts. You don't need the shorts to be perfect. You just need them to be hooky enough to put out a bunch, right?
Yeah.
And it was just seeing that output, I was like, this is just going to get better, right? It's the worst it's ever going to be.
Yeah.
It's only going to get better from here. And stuff like that just excites me, but then also worries me on the other side of,
what are we going to do all day?
for people consuming, what's the line between authentic versus just made up, right? And how do you, there's so much push for everything. If I can put out 100 shorts in less than an hour's worth of work, that means everyone can. And so that just puts more.
I had the experience. Yeah. So this year, I taught this class last spring, and I taught it this spring. And last spring was January, February was right when ChatGPT came out. And I thought I was being really smart. I said, all the other professors are kvetching about, oh no, ChatGPT, everyone's going to write their papers. And I was just like, well, you're an idiot if you don't use it. It's out there. It's a tool. So my class policy was, you should use it. And so I had this first assignment, and I got these last year, nobody was using it. So I got a bunch of random answers and a lot of questions because they were confused about it. And then this year I did the same thing, same policy, same assignment. But I'm reading through all these things. I'm like, these are pretty good. And, you know, stupid Mike didn't put two and two together. I get halfway through and I'm like, the format of the results, a lot of people use similar formats with kind of cool headings and kind of stuff. And, you know, like grading like 10 in, then I'm like, oh, dummy. They all pumped it in. And what made me wonder is kind of what you were saying about the authenticity is like, hey, guys, it's great. You had good answers, but like, did you learn anything? And, you know, as a someone trying to be an instructor or teacher or something, like, okay, so how do I create something that forces them to learn something? I don't have the answer to the question, but it's really, it's an interesting problem set. I believe it'll get solved. It's just kind of one of those things.
Yeah, in Random Short, I saw a teacher was like, hey, people are using ChatGPT for their essays. So in the essay prompt, she put some text saying, use the word Frankenstein and something, and then made the text white. So like when you copy the prompt,
you don't
see. And so if you just copy paste it and you don't like see.
Yeah, it says Frankenstein.
Yeah, and then she's like, oh, so like you just copied it and you didn't really. I don't know how much that works. It was a random short.
That's funny. It's hilarious.
I think there are people trying to, you've heard of Anthropic? They're doing like the safe AI version of OpenAI.
Okay.
So their ChatGPT is called Claude.
Okay.
So I uploaded,
I've heard of Claude.
Okay. I uploaded a transcript to Claude. I'm like, hey, write me a LinkedIn post for this. Oh, this is copyrighted content. I can't do it. I'm like, I own the transcript. They're like, okay, because you own it, I can now write about it. So I'm like, it is trying to like prevent plagiarism and stuff, but like it's not that hard to work around right now.
Right.
But I think, like you said, it's going to get there. It's going to get better.
It's interesting. We'll see. Brave new world.
Sweet. But yeah, thank you for coming on. That's all I had. Where can listeners find you? Where can they reach out? Is there anything you want to plug? We'll link everything in the description.
So they can check out Invado Group. It's a funny word. It stands for Invade, INVADO group.com. You can hit me up on LinkedIn. That's the best place to reach me. I love meeting people, so feel free. Don't be shy. I guess that's it.
Yeah. Sweet. But yeah, we'll link everything. But thank you for coming on. I think there's a lot of nuggets and key points we highlighted, but
great. I think it'll do good. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. It's fun.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for tuning into Funds and Founders. If you're a local Austin founder, a venture capitalist, or just someone who's building and in the middle of their journey and would like to be featured on an upcoming episode, submit your guest pitch to abhinavsinha.podcast@gmail.com. If you have a founder-specific event you'd like to promote on the podcast, you can also reach out to me. If you want to continue to get support through your founder journey, hit the follow button and I'll see you in the next episode.